From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some of us remember the days when you got your car loans and checkbook covers from a local bank. Remember they would offer you toasters or dish sets if you opened an account? Well, as you know, those banks don't exist anymore. There was this huge shift that took hold in the 80s. The industry was deregulated and there just wasn't enough profit in small potatoes lending. The scholar Marisa Baradaran says it left a good chunk of the American population without many options, and it didn't take long for what she calls a wild west of fringe lenders and check cashing joints to fill the void. Baradaran is joining us today to explain how we've been left with two banking systems in this country, one for the well-off and one for the rest. But how did we get to this point? That's what the show is about today, after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. What would happen if the transmission in your car went out tomorrow? It's a fairly pricey problem. What would you do to pay for the repairs? Would you write a check or give them a credit card? Some of you might pay in cash. The point is, do you have the money to cover it? And maybe you've seen some of the studies that show more than half of all households in this country could not come up with $400. For an even higher percentage of Americans, if they lost their job tomorrow, they wouldn't have enough money to last for 3 months. They'd have to find a way to borrow the money. The banking scholar Marisa Baradaran says there are more payday lenders in this country than Starbucks and McDonald's combined. And that's just one of what she describes as this wild west of fringe lenders and check cashing joints that have filled a void once occupied by small community banks. The less money you have, she says, the more you pay to use it. So today in the program, Baradaran is joining us to explain just how we got to this point where we have, as she explains in her new book, two banking systems in the country, one for the well-off, one for the poor. Her book is called How the Other Half Banks, Exclusion, Exploitation, and the Threat to Democracy. Marisa Baradaran is an associate professor at the University of Georgia School of Law. She's a graduate of Brigham Young University, where she also taught for a time. And she's joining us today from a studio in Bishop, Georgia. And Professor, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So I often begin by asking what it is that got people thinking about the subjects that they write about. So I wanted to ask you that first, because I wonder how much of it had to do with your personal story. You and your family immigrated to this country from Iran, and you've mentioned how in those early days the family was pretty poor. How much did that influence your thinking about, you know, banking and equality and inclusion?
Sure. I mean, so I actually, before that, I come from a family of, you know, revolutionaries in Iran. I mean, my mom was, you know, opposed the regime, both regimes, right, the Shah and the Khomeini, and you know, got herself in some trouble. And so we grew up, you know, with dinner table political conversations and really just being pushed to, you know, think about structures and are they fair and are they just and are there people that are being left out? And then, of course, growing up as an immigrant, especially, you know, poor, although I should say my dad later on did develop his medical practice. And so I've seen a little bit of both sides of this. And but, you know, you don't get comfortable as an immigrant, as someone who is below the, you know, income line in your sort of privilege. And so I do have deep empathy for those who struggle. And I know that it's, you know, deep down, I just know this is not a moral failing. Mm-hmm. I think we tend to think of the poor in that way. And I know I've seen too much to know that is absolutely false. And so I think it's a shame that we have so many people that struggle with things that the majority of us have no idea is a day-to-day privilege that we have, right? Like cashing our checks, yeah, and having this financial buffer. But you asked, you know, how I started thinking about this in the banking context. You know, I was on Wall Street. I was at a Wall Street law firm. Mm. for years after law school, and I was there during the financial crisis and there during the bailout. Yeah. And I saw that side of it, right? How much federal government involvement is sort of implicated in the banking sector, and just how reliant the nation's banks are on that infusion of credit and trust and just excess, you know, and not just the financial crisis, but also before.
Yeah. I want to come back to that because that's a really important point. Mm-hmm. This idea that the banking system, as you say, cannot exist without the government. And it seems like there's this myth here involved that mm-hmm. you've got the public sector and you've got the private sector. But that seems like a false sort of comparison because when you're talking about the banking system, your argument is there's no such thing as a private sector. That's just not how it works.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you can debate that outside the context of banking, but within banking, you can't understand banking and really take seriously this idea that it's a private market ruled by the laws of supply and demand. Yeah. Because credit isn't a good. It is not something that has a price based on demand or supply. I mean, credit is supplied by the federal government, right? All of us get mortgages that are guaranteed by, made possible by the federal government. So what is the price of credit? Well, it's whatever we determine it to be, you know? Mm. So interest rates are set by the federal government, unless, of course, you're poor, then the sky's the limit, right? Because they're set by whatever people want to charge. And so I think when we're talking about banking, it's a real distraction to talk about banking as a private matter. And we saw that during the financial crisis. I think, you know, starting in the 1980s, we rethought this idea that banks and governments were linked. I think before that, right, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, people understood that. Banks were heavily regulated. We didn't want to go through the Great Depression again. And then we had this revision in the 1980s where we said, oh, well, leave the banks alone, get the government out of it, and let them manage their own risks. And of course, that's fine if they wanted to do that and suffer the market consequences of not managing their risks. Yeah. And when we saw what the market consequences was, catastrophic failure, not just of the banking system, but the externalities just blow open the entire economy, not just nationally, but internationally, then it was very clear that we cannot let that happen. And so now we have to step back and say, and I don't think we've done that quite yet. We have to step back and say, okay, now that we know that the government has to be the absolute backstop of the banking sector, what do we require? What do we demand of the banking sector? How do we minimize these risks such that we're not left holding the book when the next crisis looms, which it will?
This idea of, in the subtitle of the book, that mm-hmm. Threat to democracy, that really stands out. And this is an important mm-hmm. theme in your writing. And you say in the days when the framers of the Constitution were debating the framing of that document, they were discussing mm-hmm. what sort of system is best going to serve the country. And mm-hmm. so what mattered to them, and this is important, is not just the market, how the market works, but mm-hmm. how these institutions can serve people, serve the economy. This is how you put it in the book. You say these weren't just economic ideas or ideals. They were policy principles. So there's a public part of the equation. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was writing this book, there was no Hamilton play. But I think now that we have that, yeah, I can sort of get down to the cabinet battle number one, yeah. You know, where you have Hamilton and Jefferson and what they're debating there, you know, the public debt and the bank, right? This is not about how can we make banking more efficient and more profitable. This is what kind of banking system do we want, such that the people can succeed the best. And so Jefferson's vision is we need small banks, agrarian farmers. He was wrong, by the way, right? Very, very wrong. But his vision, you know, it wins. And Hamilton says, no, we need strong central banking because, you know, we're going to be an industrial nation. And of course, he is approved right by history. And I'm glad, you know, honored now through, you know, lots of Tonys and all this. But I think that we, and that debate goes on. I mean, during the Civil War, right? Abraham Lincoln, one of the first things he does is establish a national bank and a currency. And that is hotly contested, you know, and then the Federal Reserve and the Great Depression, all of these moments in history that we think about these great leaders changing the course of our nation. And I could be not objective here, but there a lot of them revolve around banking policy, because banking policy isn't just or wasn't just about, you know, how can we regulate banks such that they're more efficient? It's what our banking system reflects about our society, culture, democracy, right? Woodrow Wilson, FDR, Abraham Lincoln, they're all very clear that banking sectors that leave out a portion of the population are not democratic. And so they maneuvered things. They broke banks down. They, you know, managed to destroy industries sometimes to preserve the union or whatever. And then we stopped thinking about it that way sometime in the, you know, 70s, 80s with the conservative revolution, but also just deregulatory forces, this idea that we had beat the old rules because we were so innovative and technologically advanced that we were just beyond those government protections. And so we started thinking, okay, well, let's treat banks like other corporations. We'll leave them alone and we'll make them profitable. And if banks are profitable, then we all become profitable.
Yeah.
But
doesn't work
we
like
lost
that.
Something. Yeah. Exactly.
It's interesting, this idea of a social contract comes up in your writing, that there's always been a social contract between banks and the state. The state says, we get something from this and you get something in return. There's this kind of social exchange. Would you talk about that, this idea of it being a social contract?
Yeah, so this is, you know, banks are the machinery of the economy, and governments need banks for a variety of things, right? We have credit programs, right? Taking the New Deal as one. We want to pump out a ton of mortgage credit. Well, we need the private sector to buy in. And so we need banks to push out and propel this credit out to average customers. And so they're the machinery that does that. But we also want them to do it on our terms, right? We want them to not exclude certain people, although during the New Deal, we definitely excluded African Americans from that deal. But, you know, otherwise, the government set these standards. And you can't get too big as banks, because then you become too powerful. And so there was a quid pro quo, we will give you this and you can make profits, you know, up to a certain extent, because then we don't want you to get too big or unmanageable or risky and put, you know, things in danger. And so that's the post-New Deal social contract. Before that, it was other things, right? There was chartering restrictions, right? So you can have a banking charter insofar as, you know, your managers are good people. They aren't, you know, running off with people's money. We were very concerned about this as a social function, because banks operate, you know, as Louis Brandeis said, with other people's money.
Yeah.
It's a different sort of business, right? We're giving them our money. We need to trust them. And so we're not just going to let a bank, you know, innovate around these rules. There's a position of trust. And so the social contract developed, and it was never explicit. I mean, sort of my term to describe a somewhat fuzzy concept, but, you know, and like, you know, I said in the 1980s, that contract was breached to some extent. And we're now working, I think, on trying to get back at, okay, well, how do we think about banking now that we know that sort of deregulation and let them just make profits at all costs didn't work?
But the social contract stabilized U.S. banking. I mean, it worked.
Yeah, it did. But and here's the thing, though. It worked for the time that it was established, right? So from 1930 to 1970, it worked. We had no bank failures, very little bank failures, a huge thriving economy. But that system wouldn't work today. Right. I mean, there was something to the bankers' complaints that we have these interest rate caps, right, red Q, but inflation was rampant. We have foreign competitors. We've got capital markets, right? You could all of a sudden put your money in a money market account, which yields more money than your bank is giving and is just as liquid. In other words, you can take it out whenever you want it.
Right.
So banks really were under pressure by market rules. And what needed to happen, what would have been best, you know, looking back in history, is for us to say, okay, so those regulations outlived their utility. We're in a different world. So let's think about new, better regulations that would help you do the thing you need to do and compete, but also not honor the fears for which those regulations were put in place, right? Too much size, too big, too powerful, too risky. And instead of doing that and having that conversation, we said, you know what, as long as we're taking out these regulations, we'll just take them all out, right? Do what you want. Now, banks are still heavily regulated, but some of those major walls that we put up during the Great Depression, we took down. And that's what caused the huge merger wave of the 1980s, right? In a decade or two, you know, you've got small banks being swallowed up by mid-sized banks. And now everything's Bank of America and Citi. And so we now have five big banks that control, you know, something like 80% of the U.S. assets. And this is Jefferson and Hamilton's worst nightmare, if we're right. getting down to it, right? And because the size comes with risk and with heavy political power. So now it becomes very, very difficult to push against these banks because they're so large and control a lot. They have a heightened voice in politics. And this is not because of Citizens United. I mean, Jefferson, Hamilton, Madison could have foreseen this. You make an industry so big and powerful that you lose the democratic ability to manage them.
So now I'm imagining you and your family sitting around the table with this group of revolutionaries arguing. And it makes more sense. The Financial Times described your book as lean and angry.
Yeah, okay.
Have you seen that?
I know. I was really surprised because the New York Times was like, this is hefty and academic. You know, so I was like, clearly two different tastes there. Yeah.
It's interesting.
I didn't write it angry. No, I know that.
But what is interesting is, I mean, they did describe it as a polemic, which I didn't see it mm-hmm. that way at all. But you're a scholar. Mm-hmm. You're trying to be sort of dispassionate at talking yeah. about the history of it. But you do head towards some kind of solution toward the end, which we'll get to. And the, mm-hmm. the Postal Service, you know, takes a role in this, which is super fascinating. We'll get to that at the end. But how did you see your role writing the book?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to be right. I didn't want to make claims that were not supported. And so there's just, you know, lots of footnotes. But I also wanted to tell a story. And when you tell a story, I think you have to, every book has a purpose, right? And so I wasn't blind to that, right? I'm writing a story, I'm writing a narrative. And of course, my views on things shape that narrative. Mm-hmm. But I also didn't want to sacrifice, you know, academic weight and, you know, sort of backing for that, right? So it is published by Harvard Press, and we did have a lot of fact checking. And so I'm not making claims that are unsupported, but I did want to make it readable and not just this dry history of banking to say, you know, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, but to put it all in perspective to where we are today. I think most people don't see it as angry, but I do hope it. There are parts of it where you do get angry.
Yeah.
I mean, I think those of us who were on Wall Street at the time and we were living under this world of like, well, this is how things are. Government's here and banks are here. And then we saw all this and a lot of us were angry. I think a lot of people who lived through the financial crisis and saw it were surprised at the way it ended up and surprised still that we haven't had a national conversation about what happened with the bailout and why we're uncomfortable with it. And you see this, right? You see this in Donald Trump, and you see this in on the left too, although yeah. I hate to compare Bernie Sanders with Donald Trump, but you know, there is a backlash that's coming out big time, and it's somewhat confused, but it's there.
Marissa Baradaran is with us, a law professor at the University of Georgia School of Law. Her book that we're talking about is How the Other Half Banks, Exclusion, Exploitation, and the Threat to Democracy. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of the U.S. banking system, which may sound kind of boring, but it is not. This story is actually really fascinating. You remember community banks, banks in small towns or communities that helped you pay off your mortgage or your car loan? Well, they don't really exist anymore. And the scholar Marissa Baradaran is helping us explain why. That's one facet of this story. She says the country has developed two systems for banking. The rich can afford a bank account with a big bank. The poor, they can't. Their options are check cashers and payday lenders who charge crazy rates and fees. So how did we get to this point? That's, in essence, what her book is about. It's called How the Other Half Banks, Exclusion, Exploitation, and the Threat to Democracy. So you point out quite early in the book, 90% of Americans think of themselves as middle class. But are they?
Right. We can't all be middle class, yeah. Right? And you know, it's funny. That number, I think, was like 2013 or something. I wonder if that's changed. I mean, the front cover of The Atlantic this week is, you know, The Secret Shame of the Middle Class.
Yeah.
And
right?
And so this is this author who considers himself middle class and he says, I'm one of the 47% of the population who can't get $400 within a month, right? So he takes that Federal Reserve statistics and gives it form, right? This is someone who you would live near. And so I think maybe there's an awakening from that. Like, wait a second. Like, you know, this is what middle class used to look like. Your home ownership, you know, you had financial security. And all of a sudden, there's a lot more families in financial insecurity, you know, they're on the edge. But we still consider ourselves middle class because we have those markers of, okay, we have a home, mm-hmm. I've got a full-time job. And that's the thing with these people that are, you know, unbanked or relying on payday loans. These are people who have jobs. These are hardworking Americans, right? They're just, you get one setback and where do you go? So these are not, you know, I was just at a conference speaking and someone was like, well, these are criminals and drug addicts. And I was like, no, you know, 47% of the population are not criminals and drug addicts. You
well, it's like there's this impression that they're losers. I mean, look at the guys that right. go into these things. They're so stupid. Right. They're getting paid these crazy, right. you know, they're getting charged these crazy rates. Your point is this is their only option. They're not dumb.
Option.
They don't lack financial right. education. They get it. This is the only option they have, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think there is this myth that, you know, the poor are financially stupid. They don't know how to manage their money. If only they knew how to manage their money, then they wouldn't be so poor and make such bad decisions. I'm like, well, if you don't have very much money, if you can barely make it, it's not money management, right? I can barely manage my money, but I've got enough that it's not a consequence to me, right? Mm-hmm. It's if I mismanage 1 month, I'll be fine. But I actually think the poor, and I can't validate this through data, but it is my suspicion that the poor actually know much more about interest rates and how much they need in a month to get by. I think they're much more vigilant about this, their money management, than those of us who don't have to be. It just makes sense to me that they would be. And so I don't think, I mean, the answer to me is not just educating them that these loans are bad, because then the response is, and I've been in community groups where people say, well, don't take out these loans. And the response is, well, then what? Right.
Right.
Friends and family can only support you just so much, and there are costs to going to family and friends over and over again. And you also have to have family and friends that have the buffer, right? And a lot of poor people live in poor communities, and they don't. So then they say, okay, well, payday lending is actually a rational choice. It's the only one where it's there, and I know what the rates are. I know they're crazy high, but that's all I've got.
Right. But it's also important to say, as you do in the book, that payday lending is not the problem. It's a symptom of a problem.
Right.
But before we get to that, let's talk about the fact that it is a problem, just in the right. sense of how it works and how bad it actually is. How does it work? If you, like I said, let's say your transmission does go out, mm-hmm. You know, and you're not really getting by. You can't come up with a $500 or whatever dollars it is, and you do go to a payday lender. What's the cycle? What's the process that kicks in?
Yeah, so you go to a payday lender, you take out, you know, let's say $500, and you borrow. You're essentially borrowing against your paycheck. So you hand over to them a check written out on your account. Okay.
Right.
Now, so these are people who actually have bank accounts. You have to have a bank account, and you have to have income. Okay.
Right.
So then the lender, if you don't, the cycle is usually 2 weeks, and if you don't pay back in that 2 weeks, then they could draw on your account. And so the backside there is, if you don't have the money there, the bank will charge you a fee. So there's two different things going on here, right? So you're getting slapped with bank fees, and then you're worried about the lender, but you're paying an astronomical rate just to take out that money for 2 weeks. And we measure interest rate in APRs, and APRs are tough because they're over a year. But some of these loans are, you know, 300, 700, 2,000% APR, depending on how many times they're rolled over. And the average payday lending customer, you know, you take out the $500, you can't get to it by in the next 2 weeks. And so you roll it over once or twice or three times. 20 or so percent of loans get rolled over 10 to 15 times. Okay, so that's a lot of rollover. You're paying fees each time. And by the time it's said and done, you've ended up paying, let's say, to take out the $500, right, something like $2,000.
Wow.
And so that is the world that these people are living in. And by the way, Utah is one of the few states in this country that has no usury limit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now that is weird. Here's the thing. I wanted to bring this up actually.
Okay.
Because the other part of your personal story, and I don't want to talk too much about your personal story. I don't want to impose too much. But the other part of your story is that your family converted to Mormonism, which helps explain your involvement with Brigham Young University. Is there a religious component to the way you think about this? You would think, because you've talked about that as a culture, we didn't used to tolerate usury, that religions in particular condemned loan sharking and exploiting vulnerable people. So how is it in a state where there's a significant population of one predominant faith that you have no limits for this?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's utter hypocrisy, and not just for Mormons, but any religious person who can tolerate this much usury. I mean, I grew up, I should say, in a Mormon / Muslim home, so it was complicated, but also, you know, multifaceted, and Muslim, atheist, whatever. I mean, we were all over the place.
Sounds fascinating. Maybe we'll have you on to talk about that later.
Yeah, another time.
Yeah.
But usury is one of those things. I mean, and I have a chapter in one of my chapters. I go through the ancient codes of usury.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that every single religion and holy text is very explicit on.
Yeah.
Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Mormonism, right? Every single one. And it's one of those sins that was like actually a sin, not like, you know, we made it up over time and we fudged around the things. This was like, thou shalt not. Like, this was viewed as something so horrible because it was, you're exploiting someone at a desperate state,
right?
So this person needs money, and because you have money, you're charging them to use it, right? And not just, I mean, usury they defined as any interest, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We eventually developed into, you know, modern capitalism and said, okay, well, usury should be at 6%, 10%. So you can make a modest profit, you know, but don't exploit. I mean, for Utah to have no limit, I mean, Utah has become the magnet for a lot of these check cashers, payday lenders, and they come and they can branch it, they can register in Utah and then export those rates nationwide. And so my state of Georgia has like a 16% usury max. We don't allow payday lending, but you can be a Utah lender essentially and lend into Georgia. And so, it is fascinating that you do have these states that have real strict guidelines on, you know, let's say gay marriage or whatever your moral issue is. And here is a moral issue, I think, that is of much bigger significance because there are actually victims here. And the victims are those who all of the scriptural texts tell us that we have the duty to protect: the poor, the needy, right, the hungry. So we're taking one of those moral guidelines that has victims that we're supposed to protect, and, you know, we put that aside. And then, I don't know, Utah just said porn is the major state problem, and fine. But I mean, I think they're like, I just think it's not even like, I mean, the Utah legislature would probably put, you know, usury not even on a list of state problems. And I think for a people that profess to be a people of the scripture, I think that's an oversight.
But at some point, obviously, as you said, not just here, but all around this country, society, as you put it, decided that this is okay.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we all of a sudden, if we saw this as a moral problem, exploiting people who are in vulnerable positions, if we saw that once as a problem, why are we seeing that now as just a market thing? It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was this free market ideology that just seeped into everything. And I should be very clear here. Like, I am a fan of capitalism because, you know, we left Iran because it was getting, you know, there was not the freedom. And so absolutely free society, free business, profits, all of that. Usury, you know, it just became, we just as a culture decided that these rules were anti-business. And this has a lot to do, I think, with just lobbying and a population that wasn't fully paying attention. You know, I think people don't really focus on this stuff. And it was a rapid change, right? So we went quickly from, you know, 10% caps in every state. And then the Supreme Court in 1978 makes a decision that any state's right interest rate can be honored in any other state. And once that happens, a floodgate opens, right? So there's a race to the bottom. And states like Utah say, well, we want to attract business. And so we're going to just have no limit. And so we're going to get the business. And then once that happens, and Idaho says, well, we can be better business, more business friendly, quote unquote. And so it becomes a race to the bottom. And bank regulators just aren't motivated to do anything about it. That's when the payday lenders come in to fill this gap, because there was no such thing as payday lending before the 1990s, when the banks just kind of left this market.
Do you think I'm being overly sentimental about those small banks like Barnes Bank in Kaysville and Bank of Utah? I mean, I could go down the list of banks that I remember where you'd go in and they'd say, you know, you get a waffle iron if you open a savings account or a BB gun or a toaster or whatever. I mean, were they all – I mean, right. It does seem like they were pretty – and of course, everyone remembers It's a Wonderful Life, which you write about.
Sure.
Because that was indicative of something. But am I overly sentimentalizing this?
A little bit, but I'm of two minds about this. Right. One is – okay, so the reason why they were giving toasters is because they were prohibited by law from giving
interest.
That's right.
Yeah.
So they were competing on toasters, and so that was a regulatory issue, right? But I think we do have this myth So starting with Thomas Jefferson and then George Bailey definitely embodies this myth that small banking is better for the community. And the myth was accurate. When we had a state mandated system of community banking, right? So for 200 years of our history, until 1994, you could only have small banks, right? Yeah. So in other words, if your bank that you are, you know, we're talking about, I can't remember the name of it, wanted to merge with Bank of America, they couldn't by law. And so once we let those merger, you know, restrictions go, then the banks could conglomerate and merge. And that made them more efficient.
Right.
But we lost a system of banking. And so I guess I'm of two minds about it. One is that, you know, that's great. There were more communities with access to banking then, but in a way that doesn't necessarily work in our modern era. And so I do hear a lot of like, well, let's break up the banks. And I'm not against that, but let's just go back to community banking. And I think we need to start thinking broader about, okay, well, what did community banking do? And maybe we can get that without having to put the genie back in the bottle.
Right.
Because it would be very, very difficult to recreate that system now that we're out of it.
Here's a comment from David. He writes, when one sector starts cannibalizing other sectors for its own profits, the whole economy suffers. Every $20 overdraft fee charged to consumers who are already out of money, that's $20 taken out of the economy. $20 taken from a consumer who would pay for a local service or a good sold in a local store and instead is giving to the investors of the bank. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about that? The general idea that, again, he seems to be getting at, David, this idea of the good, a larger good for the country, the community. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these overdraft fees are completely unjustifiable. What it is that these banks, it doesn't cost them much. If you overdraw on your account, it doesn't cost the bank much, except for they don't want the accounts that are overdrawn. These are repellents. They want you out, right? Yeah. If you have such a small account, it costs them money to hold on to, right? So in other words, a bank has the same costs for a $100,000 deposit, which they can make much more profits on than like a $100 deposit. And so if you are going to come in with $100, we're going to slap you with overdraft fees. And so you can leave, right? We don't want it. Mm. But yeah, these fees go up and they boost a bank's profits, you know, and I think it wouldn't be so problematic if it weren't heavily borne. I mean, I think 90% of the people that pay overdraft fees are low-income people, right? And so we've got this like weird, you know, incentive structure where those of us who have, like I said, the most money spend the least to use it. And if you've got too little money, you're spending constantly on these things. Payday lenders, right? A lot of these payday lenders are financed by hedge funds and pension funds. Mm. And these are, they're people's, right, savings, right? So you've got the middle class invest in a pension fund that's looking for high yield. And so they go to finance a payday lender, which exploits people down the line, right? So, and they don't know that. When you're investing in your pension, you don't know that it's going to fund a payday lender, but that's where the yield is, right? They're getting tons of returns off of those. And so you've got the middle class or lower middle class exploiting, you know, people below them without, I mean, that's just how the system works. And so there are these intricacies in this system where, you're looking for bad guys, and it's hard to do that. It's the system. Even the payday lenders, I mean, I think, you know, they're not bad guys. They're just they're making profits because in a system that we've set up for them to make profits. And that's what any good capitalist would do.
If you did away with payday lending tomorrow, you'd still have the problem, right?
Absolutely. There's a demand. There's a huge demand. And I'm with the payday lenders on this when they say, well, we're offering a service. There's a high demand for it. Sure. Right. And if they weren't there, it would come out in some other product. Right. In our state, like I said, in Georgia, payday lending is banned, but we have title lending. So you get the payday loan and you get to lose your car if you default. Yeah. So it comes up in weird ways. I think, you know, their rates aren't justified, but the business model is there for a demand. And so if you shut that down, it goes maybe black market. Or some other worse product.
Marissa Baradaran is with us, law professor at the University of Georgia School of Law. Her book is How the Other Half Banks, Exclusion, Exploitation, and the Threat to Democracy. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Marissa Baradaran. We're talking about her book, How the Other Half Banks, Exclusion, Exploitation, and the Threat to Democracy. Here's a question from Ben. We were talking earlier about that in many of these cases, they don't really have options other than title loans and, you know, payday loans. Ben writes, is there any relationship between microloans, the funds that are given mostly to people in the developing world, and payday lending or check cashing services? He's wondering if microloans work, you know, both sides. They have pretty low interest rates.
Yeah.
So could they be a model for better banking, another option instead of payday lending, for example? Would microloans work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I go through that in the book. And yeah. And microfinance, I think, it's such an over-inclusive word, right? So it covers a gamut of things, right? So anywhere from nonprofits like Kiva and those, you know, very, sort of do-gooder institutions to essentially loan sharks in the third world. And the interest rates are quite high. We do have microfinance in the U.S. There's Acción, and it does do small loans, but small business loans. So they're about $5,000, $7,000. This is a different sector, right? These are sort of seed capital. And then abroad, again, I mean, these rates can run somewhere, you know, like to as high as the payday lenders can. And there's a really broad range of these things. And there was, I mean, microfinance was like the hot thing in the 1990s. Bill Clinton met with Muhammad Yunus, you know, the founder of Grameen Bank, Shore Bank in Chicago, and they wanted to export this nationwide. But the model is, again, based on this sort of myth of communities helping themselves, right, amidst a broader sort of economic disparity. And this is, you know, my opinion, and my next book sort of, you know, that I'm working on goes into this more. But I think that doesn't necessarily address the problems. And we talked about symptoms and the disease, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that doesn't, it could be a great sort of gap filler, but it doesn't address the problem of such a disparate banking sector, right? So we're saying essentially those who can access banks, right, mainstream banks, can get all of this credit that the government, funds the banks with, right? Federal Reserve money, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guarantees on mortgages, et cetera. And then, oh, if you're in a poor community that doesn't have one of these banks, why don't you go ahead and help yourself, mm-hmm, right? So why don't you guys just pool your small resources and lend to each other while the rest of us tap into this other, you know, bigger sector? And so I think that's sort of a disparity that I'd like to see changed.
Well, you mentioned earlier, look, let's be honest, we're not going to go back to the days of community banks. That's probably not going to happen. And one of the reasons is the economies of scale. In order for this to happen, you talk about how we have to find a way for an institution to overcome the costs of lending to the poor. I mean, there's no money. And that's the reason they went under, these small banks. There's just not much money in the small potatoes lending $500 to the guy in your neighborhood. So you've got to find a way to overcome that. And you have. There's something from our past. And it's an important part of the book. And it's the Postal Service, of all places.
Yay,
yay to the Postal Service. Let's talk about this, because let's start with the way the Postal Service was established, because you've written about this and talked about this, that the framers, the founders of the democracy, said they essentially built the foundation of democracy. Is it fair to say this around the post office, the Post Service?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it is not. When de Tocqueville comes to America and he, you know, sort of looks at our democracy, he puts a lot of the emphasis on the post office, right? Because he's saying there are these loggers in Michigan that are understanding what is happening in your legislature in Washington, because they're getting a subsidized newspaper delivered on their doorstep in rural Michigan. Yeah. And that was because of the post office, right? And the founders made three decisions, right? One is that every community would be served regardless of costs, right? So the north-south routes were profitable. East-west, not so much. But regardless, every community is going to get a post office, right? No one's going to be cut off, even if it's not profitable.
Right.
Two, that they would subsidize these newspapers, right? Send them out for free, right? Or really low cost and have the merchants pay for that, right? And the other was that they would not any profits that they got would go back to the treasury. So they would remain a public institution and not driven by profits, right? So not making decisions based on their bottom line, but really be the mechanism of trade. And so you have a great, healthy market system built on this very public, democratic institution that still remains so today. I mean, the post office has been changed, and I think it's under threat of being privatized, but it is still a public institution that has in its mission, you know, every community being served, and not worried about the costs, although they will have to worry soon. They are worried now. But yeah, I mean, going back to the history of it, this is at a time where there is no federal government, right? We've got a post office before we even have a constitution. Ben Franklin was the first postmaster general. Mm-hmm. And this was something that they put a lot of thought in and made a decision that this was going to be a federal government intrusion into, you know, states' rights. But they felt like it was very important.
This idea, you talk about how banking began in the American colonies really as the way to fund the War of Independence. Right. And it seems like this is when postal banking really takes off. At the end of World War II, it was the same thing, that the government raised, I think it was something like $8 billion through these postal savings stamps. I mean, this used to be a way we raised money for ourselves as a country.
Yeah, so postal banking gets passed right after the Panic of 1907. The Panic of 1907 was a precursor to the Great Depression. And what becomes clear is that banking is not safe, right? There's all these runs that happen. They're just irrational. People just demand their money. And once a run happens, that panic spreads, and banks just don't – that's not how they operate. They don't have the money sitting in the vault, like George Bailey famously says, right?
Right.
And so the Panic of 1907 makes everyone like, okay, we need to reform the system. And so one option is deposit insurance. That was William Jennings Bryan's idea, right? Like, he's the populist. We're going to insure these. And the conservative Taft says, no, we'll just do postal banking. That's safe banking, right? Because the Treasury backs it. So starting in 1910, we have postal banks as safe banks. During the Great Depression, as banks are failing, those deposits come into the postal banks, as do all the money from the immigrants coming from abroad, right? Postal banking was already huge in Europe, still is.
Mm-hmm.
And so these immigrants were coming into America and putting their money in postal banks. And then, of course, as you mentioned, in the war, we start selling these defense savings stamps, right? And so FDR funds $8 billion of war funding and pays down Great Depression debt through these postal savings accounts. These are just small savings accounts that people would just, you know, go to your local post office, you'd, you know, put your money there. You'd get a passbook sort of savings book. Mm-hmm. A lot of people still, older people still have these things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's funny, there's another Utah connection here, right? So in 1965, Wallace Bennett, mm-hmm. who's a banking chair.
Father of Senator Utah, Bob Bennett. Yeah.
Father of Bob Bennett, who was also a banking chair. Sort of as a, I guess, prodded by the banks, or we don't know, but he is the first senator who says, let's shut it down, yeah. right? And to be fair, it was not that necessary at the time to have these postal banks, right, in 1965, because, again, we said, or we were talking earlier, that was a height of community banking, right? So mm-hmm. a lot of communities, they had a postal bank, they had a credit union, they had a thrift, they had a bank. And so there were a lot of options here, right? And so decades later, that wouldn't be the case, but we shut down postal banking and Johnson in 1966 essentially just ended the program. But again, times are different. And I think in a lot of ways, we resemble now that 1910 era,
yeah.
right, of unstable banking, real inequality where banks aren't serving everyone, than we do the 1966 era, which was really a post-war bubble, right, where there's just so much prosperity mm-hmm. and the banks were floating on all of this cheap government credit. And we're just not in that world. And so I make the proposal that we have these postal banks offer small, simple banking services, right? We're not talking about mortgages or car loans. We're just talking about, $500 in the event of an emergency, a savings account. I think that would be the most essential, right? A place to put your money that you don't have to worry about overdraft fees. Remittance, right? You want to send your money home to Mexico, Guatemala, mm-hmm. or, to New York. You could do that cheap, cash your check, whatever.
So I know that Senator Elizabeth Warren has talked about this. Senator Bernie Sanders mm-hmm. has talked about this. How far off would something like this be? I mean, do you have any sense that there's the political sentiment that would abide something like this as an idea?
This comes back to politics. So every time we talk about it, I've talked with Senator Warren on the Hill about this. I've, spoken to the Sanders team. I was at Treasury a couple weeks ago, and there's interest. But, everyone, there is some lobbies here to be worried about, specifically the payday lenders. But yes, there's a way for this to go forward without legislation. That's what everyone wants at this point. And I think that would be great and feasible. And I think we just have to get the political momentum going, right? So at this point, I think it's more of getting it on the public's radar as a possible solution. And there has been some great grassroots organizing on this. But, Washington, it's tough to get these things through, right? And these programs that benefit a bunch of people but have real concentrated costs on one particular sector are really hard to move, right? When you're talking about payday lenders, having to take a huge hit, you're going to have an interested party that's going to fight it. And then, who benefits? Gosh, the poor people of America. That not a super strong lobby,
Yeah.
So,
right.
So, it's really hard. Yeah.
If the framers of the Constitution, the early founders of the country, if one of those pillars for the postal service was that they would be supported by the Treasury, that they would be self-sustaining, mm-hmm. sure,
right,
but not profitable. They didn't worry about that part of it.
Right.
Have you worked out the numbers on this? Would it be expensive to have a postal banking system? Could it be self-sustaining?
Actually, the point is to bring in revenue to save the post office. Right. I mean, this is the biggest win-win. I can't even tell you what a no-brainer this is, right? So the post office is dying. It's $15 billion in debt that it owes to the Treasury, right? So it needs added revenue. This sector, this unbanked, underbanked sector, is an $89 billion sector, right? It's hugely profitable. If the post office could take just 10% of this sector, this could save the post office. And I should note, I spoke with the World Bank a couple of months ago, and they were telling me across the world, any post office, postal network, whatever you want to call it in other countries, that is making a profit or is self-sustaining is only doing it through banking services. Okay, we are well out of sync with the rest of the world, right? A lot of people, a lot of other countries are using their postal bank, have been since the 1800s, actually, right? Great Britain starts theirs in 1861. Japan, Germany, early in the 1900s. So, we were in sync, and now we're out. And I think this is a way for the post office to really regain some of that profitability. That wouldn't be the point, but of course it wouldn't hurt. And it really would. I mean, they're on their last breath. And that's a political move too, right? So I think the conversation around the post office right now is there's interested parties in just breaking it up, privatizing it, and selling it to the highest bidder. That's where the post office is headed. They're cutting a lot of branches, right? So that idea that we were going to have these rural places like in Utah, right, that are just not profitable. I don't know, just think of like some, you know, place that has a post office and that's all they have. That's the first to get shut down, right? And then come the less profitable areas. And that's where we're going, right? So soon it'll just be UPS and, you know, a really minimal post office that's run by for profit.
Let me ask you this finally, and it sort of brings us back to this idea that nearly half of all Americans can't come up with $400 to pay for their broken down transmission. Mm-hmm. You talk about how the postal banking system was this country's most successful inclusive experiment in terms of finances. And it created this, it not only did it provide safe banking, but it also created this culture of saving.
Yes. Would
you talk about that finally, this idea that we used to see saving as a patriotic duty? Would it reestablish this idea of the importance of saving?
Absolutely. I mean, that's my hope. That's my hope. And there is a natural experiment here in comparing us to Germany and Japan, right? When Germany and Japan are countries of savers, and they have had a postal network geared towards sort of popularizing saving, right? You've got this postal passbook. You've got these. We had these stamps. And when you're buying a war stamp, you feel like, wow, I'm helping the country and I'm saving my money, right? Germany and Japan held on to that and we let it go. And I think we really need to establish that culture of saving again.
Marissa Baradaran, professor at the University of Georgia School of Law. Her book is How the Other Half Banks, Exclusion, Exploitation, and the Threat to Democracy. She joined us from a studio in Bishop, Georgia. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a private studio, we should mention, for the voiceover artist Kelly Buttrick in Bishop, and thanks to her. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.